Hello, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. My name is Grace Linzer, and I'm the Membership Engagement Manager at an organization called PEN America. We're the sponsor for today's event. I want to offer you a warm welcome here to this event, Myth, Fate, and Family. I just want to give you a brief introduction to PEN America and our work. So PEN America, we stand at the intersection of literature and human rights to protect open expression in the United States and worldwide. We champion the freedom to write, recognizing the power of the word to transform the world. Our mission is to unite writers and their allies to celebrate creative expression and defend the liberties that make it possible. Our strength is really our membership, a nationwide community of novelists, journalists, editors, poets, essayists, playwrights, publishers, translators, agents, and other literary professionals, as well as many, many readers, a large network of those who support free expression in the United States and worldwide. As I said, I want to offer a warm welcome to you all and to our wonderful authors, James Wood and Madeline Miller. I'm going to hand it off to our wonderful moderator, Dawn Tripp. Thank you.
Thank you, Grace, and thank you all so much for being here. Welcome to Myth, Fate, and Family. My name is Dawn Tripp, and I'm thrilled to be moderating this session today with Madeline Miller and James Wood. I'd just like to start by saying I loved both of these novels. They're compelling works of fiction, artful, revelatory, wise. And as a reader, that matters to me. And while the stories are markedly different, they share several common themes that we're going to explore in our session today. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to read a brief description of each book. And so just to give you a sense of the stories. Madeline Miller's second novel, Circe, is, in a word, exquisite. Circe has been described by the New York Times as a bold and subversive retelling of the goddess's story that manages to be both epic and intimate in scope, recasting the most infamous female figure from the Odyssey as a hero in her own right. In the house of Helios, god of the sun and mightiest of the Titans, a daughter is born. But Circe is a strange child, not powerful like her father, nor viciously alluring like her mother. Turning to the world of mortals for companionship, she discovers that she possesses the power of witchcraft, which can transform rivals into monsters and menace the gods themselves. Zeus banishes Circe to a deserted island, where she hones her craft, tames wild beasts, and crosses paths with many of the most famous figures from Greek mythology, including the Minotaur, Daedalus and his doomed son Icarus, the murderous Medea, and wily Odysseus. But as her power grows, Circe draws the wrath of both men and gods, finding herself pitted against one of the strongest and most vengeful of the Olympians. To protect what she loves, Circe must summon her strength and choose once and for all whether she belongs with the world of the gods she was born into or that of the mortals that she has come to love. Circe was a number one New York Times bestseller and has received praise from The Guardian, The Washington Post, People Magazine, and others. Entertainment Weekly describes Circe as vivid, transporting. The novel explores fascinating questions about gender and power. That feels timely. The Daily Telegraph praises Miller's novel as a compelling and engagingly feminist piece of ancient fantasy. Readers who know the source stories already will delight in the craft of Miller's quietly revisionist amendments to these well-worn tales. But Circe is also a brilliantly strange work of mythic science fiction, as effortlessly expressive within the palaces of the gods as it is about the world below. Upstate is an incisive, incandescent work of fiction by acclaimed novelist and New Yorker book critic James Wood. A starred review and booklist describes Upstate as a beautifully distilled, archly revelatory tale, bright with wise insight and thoughtful tenderness. In the years since his daughter Vanessa moved to America to become a professor of philosophy, Alan Quarry has never been to visit. He has been too busy at home in Northern England, holding together his business as a successful property developer. His younger daughter, Helen, music executive in London hasn't gone either, and the two sisters, close but competitive, have never quite recovered from their parents' bitter divorce and the early death of their mother. But when Vanessa's new boyfriend, Josh, sends word that Vanessa has fallen into a severe depression and that he's worried for her safety, Alan and Helen fly to New York and take the train to Saratoga Springs. Over the course of 6 wintry days in upstate New York, the Querrey family begins to struggle with the questions that animate this profound and searching novel. Why do some people feel living so much harder than others? Is happiness a skill that might be learned or a cruel accident of birth? Is reflection conducive to happiness or an obstacle to it? If, as a favorite philosopher of Vanessa's puts it, the only serious enterprise is living, how should we live? Rich in insight and a vivid sense of place, Upstate is a powerful, restrained, and gorgeous novel. Ron Charles in the Washington Post praises Upstate for how the story captures the anxious plight of a loving father with exquisite delicacy. Its affections are large and its wisdom deep. To read Upstate is to realize just how much of each other we usually miss or ignore. Another particularly insightful review was in the Financial Times, which described how uncharted physical and emotional terrain collide in James Wood's thoughtful and thought-provoking novel. Upstate is a deceptively gentle exploration of the wounds of the past, the complex mesh of family relationships, and the ways in which they aid or obstruct our strategies for healing. The Associated Press describes Upstate as nearly flawless, and I would, in fact, agree. So I'd love to start with an easy kind of icebreaker question. I'd love to know, where did these novels begin for you? Was it a character, kind of a fragment of a scene, or something in your own life? And just if each of you could share with us where the book started.
Okay. So it was absolutely the character of Circe. That was what had gripped me for many years. And actually, my first sort of the seed of the novel goes back to when I was 13 years old and in eighth grade, and everyone in my school read the Odyssey that year in English class. And I was really excited. I had loved Greek mythology leading up to that point. So I sort of knew that there was this witch who turned men into pigs. So I was really excited to get to my own version of that. Particularly because there's so few female characters like that in Greek mythology. Oftentimes they're, you know, literally just names. They're just ciphers. They're this person's mother and this person's daughter and this person's wife. And, you know, if their story is really exciting, they get to die at the end. And usually if they're a woman who is wielding power, they have to be punished for that power by the end of the story. And Circe actually doesn't. Which is very unusual. And so the scene where she and Odysseus meet is this, you know, you think it's going to be an incredibly exciting scene, right? Here's this very powerful witch. She's complex. She's smart. She can stand up to Odysseus. But what happens in the scene when he sort of arrives at her house to try and confront her over having turned his men into pigs is that he actually has an antidote, so her spells don't work on him. And he pulls out his sword and threatens her. And she falls to her knees and screams and begs for mercy and invites him into her bed, kind of all in one speech. And I had this incredibly intense feeling of disappointment as a 13-year-old reading that, thinking, you know, that's it. That's all she gets. You know, she has this one moment of female power, and then she literally has to be put in her place on her knees. The phallic sword did not escape my notice at the time. And so I think it was really coming from this place of, I want to keep the camera on that character. You know, how would she imagine that scene? I imagine it would feel very different. And actually, in the Odyssey, the scene is told by Odysseus. It's a very self-serving scene. You know, oh, there's this really scary witch. I totally defeated her. And then she really wanted to sleep with me. You know, it's this very... So I thought, you know, let's reframe that. If that's Odysseus' version, how would Circe tell that story?
Right. Yeah, thank you.
I think I started with a journey, not with a person. It's a journey some of you will know well, and it seems to be one of the great American journeys, and it's to get on the train at Penn Station, go up the Hudson to Albany, past, you know, along the river, it's fantastic bluffs and cliffs. Once I took the train very early in the morning, and for about 20 minutes, a blue heron, you know, the train goes about 20 miles an hour, it's trundling along. The blue heron seemed to be keeping pace right down the middle of the river with the train. I've always loved that journey. It seems to me, as I say, a remarkable one, either for Americans or for non-Americans, especially remarkable, I think, for non-Americans. So if you come from, say, Britain, like I do, American rivers are really impressive. You know, they make British rivers look like piddling streams. So I always wanted English eyes seeing that river and that journey. And once I knew that, then I knew that I had to have someone visiting from Britain, and ideally it would be visiting, I thought, a child. I came to the States in 1995, and for 5 or 6 years, I could tell whenever I spoke to my parents who'd never been to the States, whenever I spoke to them about my life, it was as if I'd gone to Mars. I mean, it had no meaning for them. So I would, first of all, I was living in D.C., then later Western Massachusetts, and then Somerville. But each time, it was just lists of names. It was sort of Adams Morgan, Somerville, Northampton. Northampton, to English ears, sounds like Northampton, England. It's where shoes are made. So that dynamic of seeing, eventually they came. And of course, once they came to see where I lived, they could see what my American life was. But until then, it meant nothing. So that dynamic of seeing something with foreign eyes, but then also seeing what your child's life is, meant that I wanted a parent coming to visit a child.
And both of these novels really explore the question, among other questions, you know, how well do we really know those we love? And coupled with that, how do we transcend or break through ingrained patterns of habit and seeing in order to arrive, to really see another person in their complex entirety? And that's something that Circe, you know, reckons with, right, in a number of her relationships, and notably for me, in her relationship with her son, you know, Telegonus. And that's also something that each of the Query, each member of the Query family, Helen, Alan, Vanessa, is working to come to terms with. And that question, that sort of, you know, both novels detail that kind of visceral intensity of the bond between a parent and a child. Midway through her story, Circe describes her love for her son. I would look at him and feel a love so sharp it seemed my flesh lay open. And early on in Upstate, Alan reflects on the hunger he feels with his, you know, toward his daughters to be with them, to be near them, and the extraordinary power he describes that family had to blot out all other considerations. So I'm just wondering if each of you can talk about that, that tension, and also that journey, that search to kind of, you know, of the bond between a parent and a child in your book.
And Don, sorry to interrupt, but before they do, can you have them speak up? Because sure. You guys are so popular, it's standing there.
All right.
And they can hear you, maybe with the volume up there.
Okay,
great, thank you.
All right.
Yeah. And just,
sorry.
Yeah, put a hand up. If you can't hear us, put a hand up and I'll, give me a wave. Okay, thanks.
Do you want to?
You go ahead.
All right. I think that's right. I think actually the word I used in that quote was the obliterating power, and I raise it only because not because I think it's such a great word. Well, it isn't bad, but but it's actually just. I suddenly realized, as you were saying, there's nothing more mythical and Greek tragic than the obliterating power of family, right?
Right.
When family crosses with
definitely
fate.
Definitely Greek.
Definitely Greek. There is something absolutely all-powerful, and one of the things that I was trying to approach in this book is how little we can control. We are, again, a weirdly Greek theme, right? We are the sum of our inheritances much more than we like to think.
And we make our peace with many of those inheritances, right? We do or don't like more or less the bodies we're born with, our looks, our voices. As we get older, we realize, whether we like it or not, that we're sounding weirdly like our fathers and mothers. In fact, we could even be confused on the phone, you know, when we go home. It's like, is that you? Oh, no, it's his son. Ah, right. What we don't like to think of, I reckon, too often, is that happiness and unhappiness might be one of those inheritances too, and that it might also be oddly unamenable to change. That seems to me, you might say it's a gentle tragedy because it can be lifelong rather than massive and elemental in its sort of shattering power. But there it is. It's something as you get older, you begin to realize when you look back upon your own family, say your siblings, but also as in my case, you have children, you begin to realize just as they're born with different intelligences and different propensities and talents, so they may also be born with different talents for life. That can cause some anguished reflection.
And part of the journey that Alan takes in the course of the novel is to come to understand both of his daughters,
yeah,
in a more comprehensive way, to see them in that kind of complex entirety and not necessarily of who they've become, you know, both
right.
in relationship to him and also distinct, yeah?
Right, absolutely. And there again, I think that the journey is important. To go to a place where your daughter has been for 15 or 20 years, but you have never visited, is of course to do all the usual stuff to acquaint yourself with that life, but it's more importantly to realize that she is independent from you and
right.
has that life. And until you actually made that journey in some important way, you didn't need to consider her
right.
as being independent from you. She was just
an extension
3,000 right. miles away. Yeah.
yeah.
Well, I mean, I like that word very much, that obliterating idea. And I wanted sort of Circe's motherhood and parenting to be, you know, very all-consuming and to sort of really speak to that aspect of it. And in particular, I wanted, you know, she is a mother in the mythology, and she's the mother of, she has a child with Odysseus, whose name is Telegonus. That's a little bit of a spoiler, but it is a 3,000-year-old story. So, and, you know, what's interesting is that in epic literature in the ancient world, it's mostly about, you know, death and war and patrimony and inheritance. And so there's all these sort of very traditionally male things. And there are a lot of parent-child relationships in the ancient epics, you know, Aeneas and his son Ascanius. But you don't really get into the diaper changing. You know, you don't really get into kind of the mess of it and the nitty-gritty of what it's like to have to get a child to sleep at 3 a.m. who's screaming and won't stop screaming and you don't know why. And the reason that those things are not in the ancient epic is because they were traditionally associated with women and women were not considered important enough to be at the center of epic. And so I wanted to make those things at the center, you know, an important piece of the story as part of Circe's story. She is the one having the epic adventure and this is part of her experience as a single mother. Sorry, my voice was getting lower. As a single mother, you know, she has to deal with all that, and very much so, you know, sort of that it's so exhausting, so all-consuming dealing with an infant, particularly, you know, an infant who is having colic or difficulties, you don't know what they are, and to sort of have to keep reckoning with this person who is so insistent and so other, but so close at the same time, that sort of constant tension between, you know, everything in my being is yearning towards this creature with love, and they are so separate from me at the same time. And I think that tension is a really powerful thing.
And that's something she has to reckon with as he grows,
yeah.
too, also. And as he kind of grows beyond, you know, her expectations of what he'll become. And I think we all reckon with that as parents. Just looking at my teenager right there.
Yeah.
So Vanessa, in your novel, James, raises questions about thinking and living and happiness. And she wonders, if one knew how to think and then how to stop thinking, how to open and close the circle of thought, one flourished in life. But what if one series of circles just kept on multiplying? What if it was hard to stop thinking about pointlessness, to stop thinking about metaphysical absurdity, to stop thinking about the brevity and meaninglessness of things? Now, I know that Vanessa has what the other characters describe as a certain remove, but I, as a reader, as I mentioned to you earlier, I didn't experience her that way. Her depression is not what defined her for me.
Right.
Her character felt shot through with a kind of Wolfian, you know, sensibility, that mm-hmm. kind of vibrant, vital, existential restlessness. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder how you experienced her on the page, like both in sort of your conceptualizing of the novel, but also in the evolution of her character in the course of the story.
Well, so Vanessa is someone who has been unhappy in various phases for a good deal of her life. I think we know that unhappiness has many many modes, sometimes it manifests as anger and rage. Sometimes at its extremity, I suppose, is suicidal rage or despair. Sometimes it manifests as theatricality, a sort of histrionic, slightly self-dramatizing quality that can be tiresome for those who are witnessing it, who can't get away from it, who are sort of, you know, locked into a familial relationship with that person. And sometimes it's a little boring, which I think can be tricky for, you know, if you're trying to make that person a fictional character, because you know, we don't want fictional characters to be boring. So all those things were, I was trying to think all those things through. But then, as you say, there's another dimension, of course, which is, why shouldn't a certain level of depression be completely normal and indeed a sort of default position? I mean, you said metaphysical restlessness, right? A sort of an inquiry that you can't stop doing and having about all the puzzling aspects of life, its brevity, its painfulness, its apparent meaninglessness, unless you find a religious purpose. Those seem completely normal to me, so I wanted to dramatize those too, and it seemed fun to play up the slight comedy that she's an unhappy person who teaches philosophy. In other words, she's someone who isn't gaining the practical wisdom that you might hope to gain from, say, reading Aristotle and then telling the students at Skidmore College about, you know, Aristotle's five paths to a flourishing life. She isn't getting the memo somehow. That seemed fun to do.
But she also sees Camus as life. Right, with all its flaws, and you know, and I love that.
Yeah,
you know, that she kind of questions. She questions at the same time as she's sort of putting herself in that existential wondering. She's also, you know, testing its limits.
Right. I mean, so then there's the question of what, which is as old as philosophy, and which literature, rightly, fiction, rightly, has a stake in. Claiming, which is what is philosophy, what is academic thinking, and what is the love of knowledge and philosophical thinking, and you know, you can go to university and go through all the great philosophers, and that still doesn't have much connection, say, to reading a favorite book of mine, Camus, The Myth of Sisyphus. The Myth of Sisyphus is a book of philosophy. Jean-Paul Sartre thought it wasn't much good and thought Camus was a rubbish philosopher. But two things. Camus won the Nobel Prize. Camus won the Nobel Prize before Sartre did, which must have felt very good. And secondly, he wasn't trying to do formal philosophy. He was trying to think through the terms of our existence.
Exactly. In life, with all its sort of flawed humanity.
So
this question of meaning in a life is also, you know, it's a kind of crucible for Circe. And your goddess, she's given the powers of a god. You know, she has the, you know, she has the immortality and the eternal youth of a god. But these things that would appear to have value for her don't quite measure against her hunger, you know, to, you know, for what's mortal, you know, to feel and to suffer, to want, and even to age. There's a scene early on in the novel when Circe, I love this scene, she takes a bronze dagger of her father's and she draws it across her own hand. And as she does this, she reflects, I was not afraid of the pain that would come. It was another terror that gripped me, that the blade would not cut at all, that it would pass through me like falling into smoke. And this desire for mortal experience is woven through her story, you know, her drive to, you know, to feel. And I'd love you to speak about that briefly, because that's really so, you just capture that so well, her need to move beyond the myth. So I'd love you to talk about how that evolved for you in the course of writing the novel.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, Circe, one of the things that I love about these ancient stories is that I feel that at their core, you know, gods and monsters aside, they're very human stories. And so I see Circe's story very much that way, just as Odysseus's story is, you know, at its core, the story of this exhausted veteran who just is desperate to get home to his family and can't get there. That Circe is born into this horrendous family, who in some sense seems to have everything. You know, they live their life, the gods are, you know, blessed, and they have everything that they want, pretty much, and they have, you know, endless resources and wealth, and they live this life of idleness and feasting. And Circe feels at odds with that, and it sort of takes her a while to understand why she feels at odds, and it's because there's this, you know, underpinning of, you know, first of all, ennui and kind of shallowness, but also this underpinning of deep cruelty and lack of empathy. The ancient Greek gods were really they were so cruel and brutal. Today we would call them, you know, sociopathic narcissists, because they would step on whoever they wanted to. And if you made them angry, you know, they would punish you and your children's children, and they would never let go of that kind of that rage. Mm. And they have forgotten how to connect with other people or with someone who's suffering. All that matters to them are their own outsized emotions, but those emotions are actually incredibly shallow because they're only about themselves. And there are a few gods that are exceptions to that, one of whom is Prometheus, who she actually has a brief encounter with in the beginning of the novel. Gods who are able to feel empathy. And there's this Ovid quote about Circe. It's this very brief little thing that really sort of inspired me in her searching for more, where Ovid talks about her as having an ingenium, an inborn quality, a temperament that is more fitted for love. And Ovid is referring to romantic love, but I took that in sort of a broader sense, in the idea of empathy, and that she has the ability to, she has that quality, and she feels like there's something wrong with her parents, but she can't really put it together until she starts moving away from them and is able to get perspective. Because I think childhood is kind of like that. It feels like you're on an island, and your family, that's all you know, and so you take that for the whole world. And then at some point, you get on the boat, and you sail away, and you start to look back, and maybe you get to another island, you think, boy, that thing my parents do is really strange. And hopefully it's not strange like Circe's parents, but you know, sometimes it's good strange. But I wanted her to be sort of this questing person who feels something off and is looking for, well, what is it then? If it's not that, what is it? And she pretty much has to, you know, make herself from the ground up through trial and lots of error,
yep,
to try and find, you know, what does it mean to live in right. the world, to live a life.
So you mentioned Ovid, and I'd love to just talk briefly about myth and your novel. And as I mentioned to you earlier, when we were, you know, over at the library before we came over, in my, you know, my other life, the one I haven't quite arrived at yet, I would, you know, I would go back for, you know, to graduate school to study the classics. And I love Greek mythology. I love Greek philosophers, you know, Greek plays. And so I was in, you know, Anne Carson, and I was really excited to read your novel and what you had done with this character of Cersei. And I was curious to note that a number of reviews, you know, reference the way you, you know, you drew on the goddess from the Odyssey, you know, and kind of took the few lines that Homer, you know, allots Cersei and, you know, invented or created a really mesmerizing, you know, story. But what was so fascinating to me about your novel, and The Economist, I think, talked about that too, about how you turned to Homer and then you reworked Homer. And that's really not what you did in this book. You drew on all sorts of fragments, and not just, you know, Homeric mythology, but also non-Homeric mythology, on the Telegony and the Argonautica, and you drew on all of these little fragments of myth, and the degree of scholarship that went into this book is really stunning to me. And what you did was you took all of these different texts, written or attributed to men or a collection of men, and you identified this one woman and the way that she kept surfacing and resurfacing, and these different dimensions of her kept being revealed. And then you constructed this cogent, you know, life story of this woman. And I'd love you to talk about that. In an interview in the LA Times, you describe it this way. This is Cersei's epic, and I wanted her to be a person who makes mistakes and has regrets and goes down blind alleys. She's forging her identity, and this is not a linear process. And you do create just this sense of a life story with cogency and fire and weight. And I'd love you to talk about how, you know, the level of scholarship and kind of drawing on these different stories to create this woman.
Sure. But first of all, thank you. So there were kind of four big pillars that I was using. There are four major myths about Cersei. And they are, you know, other than kind of, you know, very small mentions, quick mentions here and there. And the four myths are the Ovid that I mentioned, where Ovid loves Cersei because she's a goddess of transformation, and his great work is the Metamorphoses, the transformations. And his take on her is sort of, she's a very pathetic figure in the Metamorphoses. She's sort of this lovelorn character who's constantly falling in love with the wrong guy, and then, you know, he's just not that into her, and then she gets angry and she lashes out. And so it's a little bit of a flat kind of stereotype. I love Ovid, but he's really interested in sort of her power and what she can do with that rage that she has, and not so much in kind of building her as a fully psychological character. And so I took the love story that is in Ovid. There's a love triangle between Cersei and Glaucus, who's a god who used to be immortal, and a nymph whose name I will not reveal here, because it is a spoiler. And she does something horrible to that nymph in Ovid. And I wanted to keep that horrible mistake that she makes, but I wanted to give her a little bit more reason for making it. And most importantly, I wanted to then make her live with it. Because I felt like, you know, that is what is important for the rest of her eternity. She has to keep reckoning with the fact that she has done this thing to another person. And so that felt in. And so trying to kind of reach out and just find these moments of resonance, or sort of things that spoke to me at the same time as pushing back. You know, I felt like I would get something and then I would push back a little bit against the source. And oftentimes it was very small details that could kind of, right, you know, inspire me in very large ways. This is going back to Homer, but one of the Homeric descriptions of Cersei is that she is the dread goddess who speaks like a human, like a mortal. And that, if you've read the novel, you will know that that was an incredibly important piece of her characterization for me. As a writer, that implied that, you know, this is a character with a foot in both worlds. She's born a goddess, but there's some piece of her that yearns for, belongs to, can communicate with the world of mortals.
Right.
And so just, it was just kind of, you know, going through. And honestly, I went all the way up to Tennyson. I have to thank Tennyson for his Ulysses poem. I didn't really mean to make that a source, and it's not about Cersei. That was a source for Penelope and Telegonus. Telemachus. Odysseus' son with Penelope, and Odysseus himself.
And so I kind of throw open the doors. I don't bring in any modern retellings, contemporary retellings, even though there's some wonderful versions of Circe. There's a fabulous Margaret Atwood poems about Circe. There's a Eudora Welty piece about Circe. I would highly recommend them all. I waited till I was finished with the novel to read them. Now I've read them. As I said, they're wonderful. But I, you know, to kind of really allow, you know, just little pieces from all over about all these characters to kind of all be part of this fertile soil. And I love doing that. You know, I love going out and reading everything I could find that mentioned Circe that's out there, and then, you know, seeing what kind of sticks and resonates.
Yeah. And so myth in Upstate, James, takes a slightly different, you know, cast. Mm. So there's the intimate family mythologies, the family stories and memory, but there's also this really fascinating tension between past and present, between, you know, not just the personal familial past of the Quarry family, but also a tension between old world and new, England and America. And there's a really extraordinary passage on pages 182, 183, when Alan, one morning in upstate New York, he wakes up to that. And it's continually sort of described in the course of that dry American light, that very particular American sky. Mm. And he recalls an incident that took place in England several years before when he went for a walk along Hadrian's Wall. Yeah. And on that walk along the Great Wall, he experienced a kind of piercing, awful sense of what he calls falling into history, where he can see his life, what he describes as a ribbon of life, and then far away in that wide, diffusely lit, invisible horizon, all of death and all the dead, past and future. And the complete passage is one of the most haunting moments for me in the novel, and I will read the book again just to kind of arrive at that passage. But I raise this because it's what you do with time in that moment and throughout the novel, the way you get right up against the intimate and ordinary moments in a father's life that could be any father that experiences that level of care and anxiety about a child. And then you hurl us out across the long throw of time. And I'd love you to speak just briefly about that and that sense of tension that's almost a pressure between old and new, past and present, and that sense of, you know, being between worlds. It's almost that experience of exile, you know, and that kind of both in the literal sense and also the ontological.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I don't know that I have anything particularly wise to say. I mean, it was a wonderful commentary that you were giving. Except, I suppose, the obvious thing that, you know, one of the few, I don't even if it is an advantage, but I was going to say one of the few advantages of getting older, one of the few advantages of getting older is that you begin to be able to see precisely a ribbon of life.
Right.
You begin to see that certain things that didn't seem to have any shape when you were 30 or 40, and probably didn't have any shape when you were 30 or 40, do have a shape. You begin to see that, say, certain decisions. So a decision that I made seemingly very lightly at the age of 30 to come to the United States, and I probably thought I was... probably thought I was coming to the States for 4 or 5 years, and then I would go back. I can now see was an absolutely, I mean, it's like a novel. I can now see, as if I were reading the novel of my life, that for this particular character named me, it was an absolutely determinative moment. There was a crossroads. I went down one road. I didn't go down the other. And I probably will never go back to live in the country I was born in. So... In all those ways, you begin to get a sense of what your own life is, but then you also have a curiosity about other people's lives and the pattern of their lives and the decisions they've made or the decisions that have been made for them or by our genes and our parents and so on. And then, again, of course, when you have kids, the temporalities begin to shift. Your own centrality is pushed to the side. And there... their futurity is what matters, right? And I think even from an early point in kids' lives, you begin to think of yourself as the person who, of course, will be surpassed. And so for all those reasons, I think, you know, fiction has to be, fiction is always drawn to these questions, and it's one of the things I like most in reading fiction is that ability to get a sense of a life in a way that is often very hard for us in ordinary life. In ordinary life, you know, we had a great friend at university, and then for various reasons, right through our 20s, we didn't see that friend. We saw that friend precisely 3 times in our 30s. And suddenly you get to 45 or 50 or 55 or whatever it is, and you realize, this great friend I may only actually have seen about 8 times in my entire life. That sense of sort of grabbing pieces of knowledge from a life, but without an ability to construct its shape, is reversed, I think, in the novel. And one of the beauties of that sort of knowledge that we get from reading about lives in fiction is getting a sense of an almost religious sense of beginnings and endings.
And you talk in your non-fiction book, The Nearest Thing to Life, you talk about that secular homelessness and the way that novelists, in a sense, are like exiles, you know, the way that constant kind of, you know, being of one world or being between, you know, between worlds.
Yeah. I mean, this is obviously something that's very useful for all writers if they can get to, if they can make the world seem something fresh and new with slightly estranged eyes.
Right.
That is absolutely crucial, I think, in the way you refigure things. I think in that regard, it's helpful to me, or has been helpful to me, it was helpful to me in writing this book, should we say, that I see America with just a slight degree of estrangement. And it's just really that crucial thing of not having the first 30 years be in any way American.
And that's also the way a fiction writer needs to look at the world that they're creating on the page, is that degree of kind of distance.
Right. And Madeline can get it brilliantly also through the whole, I mean, the God mortal thing is a gift to a novelist because suddenly you can be saying, you know, I don't know, I watched him light a fire. You know, I never fail to be interested in this thing of what mortals are doing when they're, you know, lighting a fire, and you're away, right? You've done something. So that gift is of estrangement seems important.
And that also that doubling of time, of kind of mortal time and you know, divine time, is something that, you know, your novel, you know, Circe's life is playing out, and the mortals that she's in contact with, their lives are falling away, you know, even as her life continues to have this kind of seemingly limitless trajectory. And that's really what, you know, one of the pieces that she has to come to terms with, you know, not just her exile in this place, but also her sense of being exiled from, you know, kind of that sense of mortal time, which in a way is what allows her to, you know, allows all of us to feel and be fully present, you know, to our moment.
Yeah. Well, I liked how you were talking about estrangement as an opportunity, this amazing opportunity to sort of have perspective on things. Because I think, in particular, sort of the part of that resonated for me with Circe was not only that she could then, you know, observe things in a different way, but also that in her case, you know, she's born a nymph. And in the ancient world, if you know the sort of the Greek gods, they are very, very hierarchical. And so, you know, up here is Zeus and Poseidon and Helios and all the big shots. And they can do pretty much whatever they want. Occasionally the fates will get in their way, or another god will sort of get in their way. But basically, whatever they want, they get. And then when you get down to Circe's level, you know, you're all the way down here. You're so low that you're almost human. You're basically immortal, amortal. And Circe is, and that's what nymphs are. And in the mythology, you know, nymphs are, they're pawns. They're pawns in other gods' stories, or they're prey. These are the characters who are being, you know, assaulted and pursued by the gods, and, you know, ha-ha, Zeus turns into this. But, you know, what about from that nymph's perspective? You know, and so it's a very
difficult thing to be because you have no power and you're constantly sort of having to react to these huge forces around you without being able to choose your own destiny. And so exile and estrangement for Circe is also this great gift,
right,
because she can finally just be alone as herself, without having to be, you know, pursued or harassed, or attacked with this, you know, both sort of physically but also with this, you know, toxic culture that she is surrounded by. She can be by herself and sort of discover who she actually is and what she actually thinks about things without constantly being forced into this kind of subservient female, you know, nymph role.
It's really her exile, you know, that allows for her to take that kind of rage, that kind of fury that's very true to who she is, that, you know, which is a really dynamic energy. You know, I mean, rage and fury, we kind of label it as negative, but it's not necessarily. I mean, but it allows her to channel it, you know, in a way that's affirming, you know, and you know, it allows her exile and Vanessa's exile as well, allow for this level of self, you know, a degree of self-reinvention, you know, so it turns out to be a gift also to have that estrangement. So I'd love to open up to questions from you. We have about 5 or 10 minutes left. And I think you're going to need to come up here, yeah, for questions. Yeah, thanks.
There's a quote by G.K. Chesterton that says that we know dragons, we know fairy tales are true, not because they tell us that dragons exist, but because they tell us that dragons can be beaten. Do you agree with that? I know, and I know when you were, you talked about this fabulous character of Circe, but do you also feel that you were trying to portray an essential truth, and what was that?
I'm not going to go up against Chesterton, but I will say that I did feel that I wanted her story to be a story that would have resonances with, you know, modern experience, for women, of course, because so much of what she struggles with is being undermined and silenced and belittled and kept from the halls of power, which 3,000 years later, we're still here, unfortunately. But also, you know, more generally in terms of life, in terms of what does it mean to sort of carve out a life for yourself and to break so much with your past and have to find your path and sort of find your family. And I very much wanted her story to track with Odysseus's story, that the whole Odyssey is animated with this longing for nostos, for homecoming. And she is also longing for homecoming, but she doesn't have an Ithaca. You know, she has to kind of make that home for herself. So I think that can resonate with a lot of people, I hope.
Yeah. You want to take on Chesterton?
No way.
I actually have a question about Song of Achilles. To switch it up, I think that's okay.
Sure.
So I was reading Song of Achilles on my Kindle, and I thought I got to the ending, and then there was another chapter, which was amazing. And I was wondering, did you pre-plan, I don't want to give away anything, did you pre-plan the last chapter, or did that also surprise you like it surprised me when I read the book?
So for both my novels, I actually knew the endings, and that ending was sort of part of the initial sort of my passion for the story. I wanted it to be that ending. What I don't know with my novels is I have no idea where the beginning is. And so it takes me a long time to find the beginning to get to that ending, but I did, that ending was there.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the way I write, too. Yeah.
I love your shirt. You. I feel like this person should turn around. It's an Odyssey shirt.
I'm very interested as a writer in your voice. Your source material is epic. You say that this is Circe's epic, but your voice is meditative and probing, gentle. Well, not always gentle, but it's meditative and probing. We'll stick to that. I'm wondering how you arrived at that very distinct and very different voice from the source material.
Thank you. So the question was about, I don't know if everyone can hear back there, was about Circe's voice. That is partially what takes me so long. I have a background in theater, and it is incredibly important to me. I'm a theater director. To be able to hear the character's voice in an authentic way and really have them speaking in my head, I sort of feel like I'm getting into character. And it takes, you know, 5 years of writing and throwing out and writing and throwing out to sort of be able to hear that voice. And I can now sort of intellectualize about that voice and say that I wanted there to be this sort of odd formality, kind of alienness to her voice that comes of her being an eternal being born among the gods and living for hundreds of years, but also a real directness to it that comes from her, you know, just her personality. She's a very open, earnest person. As well as sort of infused with her love of the natural world. So now I can say all that. But 5 years, that was sort of me figuring that out. So it's a very organic process. And it has to feel like the character is really, you know, I can really hear her. And I never want to be reaching for something as I'm writing. I want it to just sort of, I have to kind of get the whole thing at once. And what happens around year five is that I usually get the first line of the novel. And then once I have the first line, then I can go.
So, and do you rewrite at that point?
Oh, absolutely. I rewrite always. I'm a huge rewriter.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, I would love to hear you talk about voice, actually.
I rewrite a lot, too. But I don't have the same... I think that question was really interesting because it's how you define a voice against a certain tradition and a set of texts, and that is interesting to me. And I'm also really interested in that thing that you were talking about, of formality, because most contemporary fiction, of course, when, say, first-person narration or when characters are speaking to each other, is we're terrified of formality. That seems sort of lifeless and arch and old-fashioned, and I actually like all the possibilities for a certain formality of diction, particularly when it's a first-person narration. Although I used third-person. But right. Anyway.
Hi. So you guys talked about exile a little bit already, and I noticed after reading Song of Achilles and then reading Circe, the main characters in both were banished and then kind of found themselves through banishment. I was wondering if you realized that while you were writing both, if that was intentional for you, or if that was part of why you were drawn to those characters.
That was absolutely part of what drew me to those characters. I think in retrospect, I was aware of that similarity. I think there are a lot of differences between Circe and Patroclus as people and as narrators, but yes, I mean, I'm really interested in that, in how the opportunity, as I was saying, of exile, and how these two people can sort of find yourself in a whole new place, and in that whole new place, you can become both whole, you know, and new. And so that was important. And going back to what the other person said about voice, with Patroclus in particular, it was fun to have him, to have a real contrast between sort of the mode he was in this epic mode. He gets sucked into the epic world because he loves Achilles. And Achilles is living, has chosen to live an epic life and be, you know, famous forever and die young, the ultimate epic choice. But I wanted Patroclus' voice to be actually very lyric and from the tradition of ancient lyric poetry. So the way I shaped Patroclus' voice was coming from Sappho and Catullus and writers like that, as opposed to the world of Homer. So I didn't want formality in his. I wanted it to be this very, this voice that was very grounded in, you know, daily life and personal life and love and friendship and sort of all those subjects of lyric poetry, as opposed to, you know, destiny and fate and angry gods and war. That's epic. So that exile felt really important because it sort of allowed him to slip out of that life and kind of find this other path.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question.
So what is the correct pronunciation? Is it Circe or is it Kyrke?
Great question. So the ancient Greek is Kyrke. It would be a hard C.
Yeah.
Same thing with, you know, Kikero. So what I do, sort of my mode for the way I deal with this is that if the name is known, I use the most commonly known version of the name. If the name is not known, I go with the ancient Greek. So that's why I used Iaia with an I. You'll sometimes see it as with
that.
An E.
Yeah.
But the I is the Greek way. So if it's not very well known, I go with the Greek. But, you know, it would have been Kyrke.
Thank you.
Sure.
These things are completely incomprehensible. So my dad's nickname at school, some of you will know this, was Silva, Latin for wood or forest, except that in the English tradition, you didn't pronounce the V's. I don't know if they still do that in the States. So you pronounce the V's as W's. So in fact, his nickname was Silwa. So the idea of my dad, some kid bumping into him in the schoolyard and saying, Silwa, I've come to bully you. Seems quite funny, but anyway. So pronunciation.
I love that story because I was also taught to use the W when I was growing up. And so occasionally when I say the word gravitas, I say it as gravitas, which sounds really goofy. And you know, my husband's always on my case. He's like, you sound like you're like Bugs Bunny when you say it that way. So
great. And I think we can do one more question. Yeah.
So one of the things I really like about Circe is that it challenges sort of the, I guess, misogyny of a lot of the myths. And so I guess my question to you, both of you, is how do you challenge sort of these conceived beliefs and values that permeate through our culture and literature?
We could probably all three answer that question.
Yeah.
No, go ahead, though.
I was trying to bring everything.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate it. Yeah, it's a question that I feel like I constantly wrestle with as a novelist and as a writer.
Yeah, indeed. Well, specifically, if you're talking about misogyny or just plain old sexism, one thing would be the now famous Bechdel test. In other words, it would be, say, having two sisters talk to each other about something other than their dad. How's that? Right? About their own lives, whether competitively or benignly, but to be really relating to each other rather than relating to a more powerful figure in the clan or family.
In the Odyssey and sort of throughout representations of Circe, I feel like she is the incarnation of male anxiety about female power. That if women have power, men are getting turned into pigs. And in the Middle Ages, you know, it was the illustration for those manuals about how to control your wife. It was always Circe. You know, this is what happens if you let things get out of hand, Circe. And it's such a zero-sum way of thinking, you know, that if we give to women, we must be taking from men. I completely disagree with that. I think that the more freedom that women have, you know, to break out of the constrictions of their lives, the more freedom men also have. I think it's an all boats rise thing. So I absolutely made that a part of the novel, as well as challenging, you know, that absurd statement about Circe. But also to sort of point out the fact that, you know, that there are other characters. There are lots of characters who are struggling with the constrictions, like Odysseus' son, who doesn't want to be like his father. And that you know, we can all challenge those things, and that's a positive.
Yeah. Great. Thank you all so much for coming. And I just want to remind you that the authors will be signing books at the table. And thank you for being here.